see what's going on, though we've seen vehicles arriving and leaving the area. What appeared to be a large refrigerated truck left the area a few minutes ago, and there is speculation that this truck was transporting bodies. The reporter paused for effect, then continued, "Authorities haven't released an official statement, but a spokesperson from the National Transportation Safety Board told reporters that toxic fumes had overcome the passengers and crew, and there are some fatalities. The aircraft, though, has landed safely, and all we can do is hope and pray that there are few fatalities." The anchorwoman asked, "Larry, we're hearing rumors that the aircraft was out of radio contact for several hours before it landed. Have you heard anything about that?" Larry, the on-the-scene guy, said, "The FAA has not confirmed that, but an FAA spokesperson did say that the pilot radioed in that he was experiencing some fumes and smoke on board, and he thought it was something chemical or maybe an electrical fire." This was news to me, but not to Ted Nash, who commented cryptically, "I'm glad they're getting their facts straight." Facts? It seemed to me that lacking any smoke in the aircraft, someone was manufacturing it and blowing it up everyone's ass. The radio reporter and the anchor lady were going on about the Swiss air tragedy, and someone recalled the Saudi air tragedy. Nash turned off the radio. I realized Kate was looking at me. She said softly, "We don't know what happened, John, so we won't speculate. We'll avoid talking to the news media." Right. Just what I was thinking. I realized I had to watch what I said. What I was also thinking was that the federal law enforcement and intelligence agencies were sort of like a cross between the Gestapo and the Boy Scouts. The iron fists and the velvet glove and all that. Don't speculate meant shut up. Not wanting to wind up in protective custody for a year or maybe worse, I said with real sincerity, "I'll do whatever I have to do to bring this guy to justice. Just keep me on the case." Neither of my teammates replied, though they could have reminded me that I wanted out not too long ago. Ted Nash, super spy, gave Officer Simpson an address a block away from Federal Plaza. I mean, geez, the guy's a cop, and even if he was stupid, he could figure out that we were going either to 26 Federal Plaza or 290 Broadway, the new Fed building across the street from Fed Plaza. In fact, Simpson said, "You want to walk to Federal Plaza?" I laughed. Nash said, "Just pull over here." Officer Simpson pulled over on Chambers Street near the infamous Tweed Courthouse, and we all got out. I thanked him for driving us, and he reminded me, "I have damage to the front of the patrol car." "Charge it to the feds," I said. "They're collecting $1 trillion today." We began walking up Lower Broadway. It was dusk now, but it's always dusk down here in the skyscraper caverns of Lower Manhattan. This was not a residential or shopping district. It was a government district, so there weren't many people around on a Saturday, and the streets were relatively quiet. As we walked, I said to Mr. Nash, "I have this sort of impression that maybe you guys knew we'd have a problem today." He didn't reply right away, then said, "Today is April 15. "Right. I got my tax return in yesterday. I'm clean." Muslim extremists attach a lot of significance to anniversary dates. We have a lot of watch dates on our calendar. "Yeah? What's today?" "Today," said Ted Nash, "is the anniversary date of when we bombed Libya in 1986. "No kidding." I asked Kate, "Did you know that?" "Yes, but I attached little significance to it, to be honest with you." Nash added, "We've never had an incident on this date before, but Muammar Gaddafi makes an anti-American speech every year on this date. In fact, he made one earlier today." I mulled this over a while, trying to decide if I'd have acted any differently if I'd known this. I mean, this kind of stuff was not in my clue bag, but if it was, I might have at least put it into my paranoia pocket. I love being a mushroom, as you can imagine, kept in the dark and fed a lot of shit. And I asked my teammates, "Did you forget to tell me?" Nash replied, "It didn't seem terribly important. I mean, important that you know." I see, which means fuck you, of course. But I was learning to talk the talk. I asked, how did Khalil know he'd be transported today? Nash replied, well, he didn't know for sure, but our Paris embassy can't or won't hold a man like this for more than 24 hours. That much he probably knew, and if we had held him in Paris longer, nothing would have been much different, except for the missed symbolic date. Okay, but you played his game and transported him on the 15th of April. That's right, answered Mr. Nash. We played his game, wanting to arrest him here on the 15th. I think you're going to miss the date. He didn't reply to this, but informed me. We took extraordinary security precautions in Paris, at the airport and on the aircraft. In fact, there were also two federal air marshals on board undercover. Good. Then nothing could go wrong. He ignored my sarcasm and said, there is a Hebrew expression shared by the Arabs that says, man plans, God laughs. Good one. We reached the 28-story skyscraper called 26 Federal Plaza, and Nash said to me, Kate and I will do the talking. Speak only if spoken to. Can I contradict you? You'll have no reason to, he said. This is the one place where only the truth is spoken. So with that bit of Orwellian information in my head, we entered the great Ministry of Truth and Justice. April 15, I reflected, now sucked for two reasons. Book 2. Libya, April 15th, 1986. The airstrike will not only diminish Colonel Gaddafi's capacity to export terror, it will provide him with incentives and reasons to alter his criminal behavior. President Ronald Reagan. It is a time for confrontation, for war. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Chapter 13. Lieutenant Chip Wiggins, Weapons Systems Officer, United States Air Force, sat silent and motionless in the right seat of the F-111F attack jet, codenamed Karma 57. The aircraft was cruising along at a fuel-saving 350 knots. Wiggins glanced at his pilot, Lieutenant Bill Satherwaite, to his left. Ever since they'd taken off from the Royal Air Force Station, Lackenheath, in Suffolk, England, some 2 hours before, neither man had said much. Satherwaite was the silent type anyway, Wiggins thought, and not given to useless chatter. But Wiggins wanted to hear a human voice, any voice. So he said, we're coming abeam of Portugal. Satherwaite replied, I know that. Right. Their voices had a slight, metallic ring to them as the words filtered through the open cockpit interphone that was the actual verbal connection between the two men. Wiggins took a deep breath, sort of a yawn, beneath his flight helmet, and the increased flow of oxygen caused the open interphone connection to reverberate for a second. Wiggins did it again. Satherwaite said, would you mind not breathing? Whatever makes you happy, Skipper. Wiggins squirmed a little in his seat. He was getting cramped after so many hours of sitting restrained in the F-111's notoriously uncomfortable seat. The black sky was becoming oppressive, but he could see lights on the distant shore of Portugal, and that made him feel better for some reason. They were on their way to Libya, Wiggins reflected, on their way to rain death and destruction down on Muammar Gaddafi's pissant country in retaliation for a Libyan terrorist attack a couple of weeks ago on a West Berlin disco, frequented by American military. Wiggins recalled that the briefing officer made sure they knew why they were risking their lives in this difficult mission. Without too much spin, the briefing officer told them that the Libyan bomb attack on La Belle Disco, which killed one American serviceman and injured dozens of others, was just the latest in a series of acts of open aggression that had to be answered with a display of resolve and force. Therefore, said the briefing officer, you're going to blow the shit out of the Libyans. Sounded good in the briefing room, but not all of America's allies thought this was a good idea. The attack aircraft from England had been compelled to take the long way to Libya because the French and the Spanish had refused them permission to cross over their airspace. This had angered Wiggins, but Satherwaite didn't seem to care. Wiggins knew that Satherwaite's knowledge of geopolitics was minus zero. Bill Satherwaite's life was flying, and flying was his life. Wiggins thought that if Satherwaite had been told to bomb and strafe Paris, Satherwaite would do it without a single thought about why he was attacking a NATO ally. The scary thing, Wiggins thought, was that Satherwaite would do the same thing to Washington, D.C., or Walla Walla, Washington, with no questions asked. Wiggins pursued this thought by asking Satherwaite, "Bill, did you hear that rumor that one of our aircraft is going to drop a fuck-you bomb in the backyard of the French embassy in Tripoli?" Satherwaite did not reply. Wiggins pressed on. "I also heard that one of us is going to drop a load on Gaddafi's Al-Azizia residence. He's supposed to be there tonight." Again, Satherwaite did not answer. Finally, Wiggins, annoyed and frustrated, said, "Hey, Bill, are you awake?" Satherwaite replied, "Chip, the less you know and the less I know, the happier we will be." Chip Wiggins retreated into a moody silence. He liked Bill Satherwaite and liked the fact that his pilot was of the same rank as he and couldn't order him to shut up. But Satherwaite could be a cold, taciturn son of a bitch in the air. He was better on the ground. In fact, when Bill had a few drinks in him, he seemed almost human. Wiggins considered that maybe Satherwaite was nervous, which was understandable. This was, after all, according to the ops briefing, the longest jet attack mission ever attempted. Operation El Dorado Canyon was about to make some kind of history, though Wiggins didn't know what kind yet. There were 60 other aircraft somewhere around them, and their unit, the 48th Tactical Fighter Wing, had contributed 24 F-111 swing wing jets to the mission. The tanker fleet that was flying down and back with them was a mix of the huge KC-10s and the smaller KC-135s, the 10s to refuel the fighters and the 135s to refuel the KC-10s. There would be three mid-air refuelings on the 3,000-mile route to Libya. Flying time from England to the Libyan coast was 6 hours. Flying time toward Tripoli in the pre-attack phase was half an hour, and time over target would be a long, long 10 minutes. And then they'd fly home. Not all of them, but most of them. "History," Wiggins said. "We are flying into history." Satherwaite did not reply. Chip Wiggins informed Bill Satherwaite, "Today's income tax day. Did you file on time?" "Nope. Filed for an extension." "The IRS focuses on late filers." Satherwaite grunted a reply. Wiggins said, "If you get audited, drop napalm on the IRS headquarters. They'll think twice before they audit Bill Satherwaite again." Wiggins chuckled. Satherwaite stared at his instruments. Unable to draw his pilot into conversation, Wiggins went back to his thoughts. He contemplated the fact that this was a test of endurance for crew and equipment, and they'd never trained for a mission like this. But so far, so good. The F-111 was performing admirably. He glanced out the side of his canopy. The variable wing was extended at 35 degrees so as to give the airplane its best cruise characteristics for the long formation flight. Later, they'd hydraulically sweep the wings back to a streamlined aft position for the attack, and that would mark the moment of the actual combat phase of the mission. Combat. Wiggins really couldn't believe he was going into actual Jesus H. Christ combat. This was the culmination of all they'd been trained for. Both he and Satherwaite had missed Vietnam, and now they were flying into unknown and hostile territory against an enemy whose anti-aircraft capabilities were not well known. The briefing officer had told them that the Libyan air defenses routinely shut down after midnight, but Wiggins couldn't believe that the Libyans were quite that stupid. He was convinced that their aircraft would be picked up on Libyan radar, that the Libyan Air Force would scramble to intercept them, that surface-to-air missiles would rise to blow them out of the sky, and that they would be greeted by AAA, which did not mean the American Automobile Association. Marcus Aurelius. What? The only Roman monument still standing in Tripoli, the Arch of Marcus Aurelius, 2nd century A.D. Satherwaite stifled a yawn. If anybody hits it by mistake, they're in big trouble. It's a UN-designated World Heritage Site. Were you paying attention at the briefing? Chip, why don't you chew gum or something? We begin our attack just west of the arch. I hope I get a glimpse of it. That kind of stuff interests me. Satherwhite closed his eyes and exhaled in an exaggerated expression of impatience. Chip Wiggins returned to his combat thoughts. He knew that there were a few Vietnam vets on this mission, but most of the guys were untested in combat. Also, everyone from the president on down was watching, waiting, and holding their breath. After Vietnam, and after the Pueblo fiasco, and Carter's screwed-up rescue mission in Iran, and a whole decade of military failure since Vietnam, the home team needed a big win. The lights were on in the Pentagon and the White House. They were pacing and praying. Win this one for the Gipper, boys. Chip Wiggins wasn't going to let them down. He hoped they wouldn't let him down. He'd been told that the mission could be aborted at any time, and he feared the crackle of the radio with the code words for abort. Green grass, as in the green, green grass of home. But a little piece of his mind would have welcomed those words. He wondered what they'd do to him in Libya if he had to bail out. Where did that thought come from? He was starting to think bad things again. He glanced at Satherwaite, who was making an entry in his log. Satherwaite yawned again. Wiggins asked, "Tired?" "No." "Scared?" "Not yet." "Hungry?" "Chip, shut up." "Thirsty?" Satherwaite said, "Why don't you go back to sleep? Or better yet, I'll sleep and you fly." Wiggins knew this was Satherwaite's not-too-subtle way of reminding him that the weapons system officer was not a pilot. They sat again in silence. Wiggins actually considered catching a nap, but he didn't want to give Satherwaite the opportunity to tell everyone back at Lackenheath that Wiggins slept the whole way to Libya. After about half an hour, Chip Wiggins looked at his navigation chart and instruments. In addition to his job as weapons systems officer, he was also the navigator. He said to Satherwaite, "At 9 o'clock is Cabo de São Vicente, Cape St. Vincent." "Good, that's where it belongs. That's where Prince Henry the Navigator set up the world's first school for sea navigation. That's how he got his name." "Henry?" "No, Navigator." "Right." The Portuguese were incredible mariners. "Is this something I need to know?" "Sure. You play Trivial Pursuit?" "No. Just tell me when we're going to change heading." "In 7 minutes, we'll turn to 094. "Okay, keep the clock." They flew on in silence. Their F-111 was in an assigned position in their cruise flight formation, but because of radio silence, each aircraft maintained position by use of their air-to-air radar. They couldn't always visually see the other three aircraft in their flight formation, codenamed Elton 38, Remit 22, and Remit 61, but they could see them on radar and could key off the flight leader, Terry Wycliffe, in Remit 22. Still, Wiggins had to anticipate the flight plan to some extent and know when to stare at the radar screen to see what the lead aircraft was doing. "I enjoy the challenge of a difficult mission, Bill, and I hope you do, too." "You're making it more difficult, Chip." Wiggins chuckled. The flight of four F-111s all began their turn to port in unison. They rounded Cabo de São Vicente and headed southeast, aiming right for the Strait of Gibraltar. An hour later, they were approaching the Rock of Gibraltar on the port side and Mount Hacho on the African coast to starboard. Wiggins informed his pilot, "Gibraltar was one of the ancient pillars of Hercules. Mount Hacho is the other. These landmarks defined the western limits of navigation for the Mediterranean civilizations. Did you know that?" "Give me a fuel state." "Right." Wiggins read the numbers off the fuel gauges, commenting, "Remaining flight time about 2 hours. Satherwaite looked at his instrument clock and said, "The KC-10 should be rendezvousing in about 45 minutes. "I hope," Wiggins replied, thinking, "if we somehow miss the refueling, we'll have just enough fuel to get us to Sicily and we'll be out of the action." They had never been out of range of land, and if they'd had to, they could jettison their bombs in the drink and put down at some airport in France or Spain and casually explain that they'd been on a little training mission and had run short of fuel. As the briefing officer had said, "Do not use the word Libya in your conversation," which had gotten a big laugh. 30 minutes later, there was still no sign of the tankers. Wiggins asked, "Where the hell is our flying gas station?" Satherwaite was reading from the mission orders and didn't reply. Wiggins kept listening for the code signal over the radio that would announce the approach of the tankers. After all this time in the air and all this preparation, he didn't want to wind up in Sicily. They flew on without speaking. The cockpit hummed with electronics, and the airframe pulsed with the power of the twin Pratt and Whitney turbofans that propelled the F-111F into the black night. Finally, a series of clicks on the radio told them that the KC-10 was approaching. After another 10 minutes, Wiggins saw the contact on his radar screen and announced the approach to Satherwaite, who acknowledged. Satherwaite pulled off power and began to slide out of the formation. This, Wiggins thought, was where Satherwaite earned his pay. In a few minutes, the giant KC-10 tanker filled the sky above them. Satherwaite was able to speak to the tanker on the KY-28 secured and scrambled voice channel, which could be used for short-range transmissions. Kilo 10, this is Karma 5-7, you're in sight. Roger, Karma 5-7, here comes Dickie. Roger. The KC-10 boom operator carefully guided the refueling nozzle into the F-111's receptacle just aft of the fighter's cockpit. Within a few minutes, the hookup was completed and the fuel began to flow from the tanker to the fighter. Wiggins watched as Satherwaite finessed the control stick in his right hand and the engine throttles in his left to maintain the jet fighter in exact position so that the refueling boom would stay connected. Wiggins knew this was an occasion for him to stay silent. After what seemed like a long time, the green light near the top of the tanker's boom flicked off, and an adjacent amber light came on, indicating an auto disconnect. Satherwaite transmitted to the tanker, Karma 5-7 clearing, and eased his aircraft away from the KC-10 and back toward his assigned spot in the formation. The tanker pilot, in acknowledgement that this was the last refueling before the attack, transmitted, Hey, good luck. Kick ass. God bless. See you later. Satherwaite responded, Roger. Then said to Wiggins, Luck and God have nothing to do with it. Wiggins was a little annoyed at Satherwaite's too cool jet jockey crap and said to him, Don't you believe in God? I sure do, Chip. You pray. I'll fly. Satherwaite tucked them back into the formation as another jet peeled off for its refueling. Wiggins had to admit that Bill Satherwaite was a hell of a pilot, but he wasn't a hell of a guy. Satherwaite, aware that he'd ticked off Wiggins, said, Hey, Wizzo. Using the affectionate slang term for a weapons officer, I'm gonna buy you the best dinner in London. Wiggins smiled. I pick. No, I pick. We'll keep it under 10 pounds. Figures. Satherwaite let a few minutes go by, then said to Wiggins, It's going to be okay. You're going to drop them right on target, and if you do a good job, I'll fly right over that Arch of Augustus for you. Aurelius. Right. Wiggins settled back and closed his eyes. He knew he'd gotten more than Satherwaite's quota of non-mission words, and he considered that a small triumph. He thought ahead a bit. Despite the small knot in his empty stomach, he was really looking forward to flying his first combat mission. If he had any qualms about dropping his bombs, he reminded himself that all their mission targets, his own included, were strictly military. In fact, the briefing officer at Lakenheath had called the Al Azizia compound Jihad University, meaning it was a training camp for terrorists. The briefing officer had added, however, there is a possibility of some civilians within the military compound of Al Azizia. Wiggins thought about that, then put it out of his mind. Chapter 14. Assad Khalil struggled with two primitive instincts, sex and self-preservation. Khalil paced impatiently across the flat roof. His father had named him Assad, the lion, and it seemed that he had consciously or unconsciously taken on the traits of the great beast, including this habit of pacing in circles. He suddenly stopped and looked out into the night. The gobbly, the hot, strong southerly wind from the vast Sahara was blowing across northern Libya toward the Mediterranean Sea. The night sky appeared misty, but in fact the distortion of the moon and stars was caused by airborne grains of sand. Khalil looked at the luminous face of his watch and noted that it was 1:46 a.m. Bahira, the daughter of Captain Habib Nadir, was to arrive at precisely 2 a.m. He wondered if she would come. He wondered if she had been caught. And if she'd been caught, would she confess to where she was going and with whom she was going to meet? This last possibility troubled Asad Khalil greatly. At 16 years old, he was perhaps 30 minutes away from his first sexual experience, or he was several hours away from being beheaded. He saw an uninvited mental image of himself on his knees, head bowed as the massively built official executioner, known only as Suleiman, swung the giant scimitar toward the back of Khalil's neck. Khalil felt his body tense, and a line of sweat formed on his forehead and cooled in the night air. Khalil walked to the small tin shed on the flat rooftop. There was no door on the shed, and he peered down the staircase, expecting to see either Bahira or her father with armed guards coming for him. This was lunacy, he thought. Pure madness. Khalil moved to the north edge of the roof. The concrete rooftop was surrounded by a shoulder-high, crenellated parapet of block and stucco. The building itself was a two-story-high structure built by the Italians when they controlled Libya. The building was then, as it was now, a storage facility for munitions, which was why it was safely removed from the center of the military compound known as Al-Azizia. The former Italian compound was now the military headquarters and sometimes residence of the great leader, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, who this very night had arrived at Al-Azizia. Khalil and everyone else in Libya knew that the great leader made a habit of changing locations often, and that Gaddafi's erratic movements were a safeguard from either assassination or an American military action. But it was not a good idea to comment on either possibility. In any case, Gaddafi's unexpected presence had caused his elite guards to be unusually alert this night, and Khalil was worried because it seemed that Allah himself was making this assignation difficult and dangerous. Khalil knew beyond a doubt that it was Satan that had filled him with this sinful lust for Bahira, that Satan had made him dream of her walking naked across moonlit desert sands. Asad Khalil had never seen a naked woman before, but he had seen a magazine from Germany, and he knew what Bahira would look like unveiled and undressed. He pictured each curve of her body as he imagined it would be. He saw her long hair touching her bare shoulders. He recalled her nose and mouth as he'd seen them when he and she had been children, before she was veiled. He knew she looked different now, but strangely the child's face still sat on a wonderfully imagined woman's body. He pictured her curving hips, her mound of pubic hair, her naked thighs and legs. He felt his heart beating heavily in his chest and felt his mouth become dry. Khalil stared out to the north. The lights of Tripoli, 20 kilometers distant, were bright enough to be visible through the glowing gobli. Beyond Tripoli lay the blackness of the Mediterranean. Around Al-Azizia was rolling arid land, some olive groves, date trees, a few goatherd shelters, an occasional watering hole. Asad Khalil peered over the parapet down into the compound. All was quiet below. There were no guards visible nor any vehicles at this hour. The only activity would be around Colonel Gaddafi's residence and around the headquarters area that housed the command, control, and communication buildings. There was no special alert tonight, but Khalil had a premonition that something was not right. Asad Khalil looked again at his watch. It was exactly 2 a.m., and Bahira had not arrived. Khalil knelt down in the corner of the parapet, below the line of sight of anyone on the ground. In the corner he had unrolled his sajada, his prayer mat, and placed on it a copy of the Quran. If they came for him, they would find him praying and reading the Quran. That might save him. But more likely they would guess correctly that the Quran was a ruse and his sajada was for the naked body of Bahira. If they suspected that, then his blasphemy would be dealt with in a way that would make him wish for beheading. And Bahira? They would most likely stone her to death. And still, he did not run back to his mother's house. He was determined to meet whatever fate came up those stairs. He thought of how he'd first noticed Bahira at her father's house. Captain Habib Nadir, like Khalil's own father, was a favorite of Colonel Gaddafi. The three families were close. Khalil's father, like Bahira's father, had been active in the resistance to the Italian occupation. Khalil's father had worked for the British during the Second World War, while Bahira's father had worked for the Germans. But what did that matter? Italians, Germans, British, they were all infidels, and they were owed no loyalty. His father and Bahira's father had joked about how they had both helped the Christians kill one another. Khalil thought a moment about his father, Captain Karim Khalil. He had been dead 5 years now, murdered on the street in Paris by agents of the Israeli Mossad. The Western radio broadcasts had reported that the murder was probably committed by a rival Islamic faction, or perhaps even by fellow Libyans in some sort of political power play. No arrest had been made. But Colonel Gaddafi, who was far wiser than any of his enemies, had explained to his people that Captain Karim Khalil had been murdered by the Israelis, and everything else was a lie. Asad Khalil believed this. He had to believe. He missed his father, but took comfort from the fact that his father had died a martyr's death at the hands of the Zionists. Of course, doubts did creep into his head, but the great man himself had spoken, and that was the end of it. Khalil nodded to himself as he knelt in the corner of the roof. He looked at his watch, then at the doorway of the tin shed 10 meters away. She was late, or she had not been able to slip out of her house, or she'd overslept, or she had decided not to risk her life to be with him. Or worst of all, she had been caught and even now was betraying him to the military police. Khalil considered his special relationship with the great leader. He had no doubt that Colonel Gaddafi was fond of him and his brothers and sisters. The colonel had let them stay on in their house in the privileged compound of Al-Aziziyah. He had seen to it that his mother had a pension and that he and his siblings were educated. And only 6 months ago, the colonel had said to him, "You are marked to avenge your father's death." Asad Khalil had been filled with pride and joy and replied to his surrogate father, "I am ready to serve you and to serve Allah." The colonel had smiled and said, "We are not ready for you, Asad. Another year or two and we will begin training you to be a freedom fighter." And now Asad was risking everything, his life, his honor, his family, all for what? For a woman. It made no sense, but there was the other thing, the thing he knew but could not bring himself to think. The thing with his mother and with Muammar Gaddafi. Yes, there was something there, and he knew what it was, and it was the same thing that had put him here on the roof, waiting for Bahira. He reasoned that if the relationship between his mother and the great leader was not a sin, then not all sex outside of marriage was sinful. Muammar Gaddafi would not do anything sinful, anything outside the Sharia, the accepted way. Therefore, Asad Khalil, if caught, would take his case directly to the great leader and explain his confusion concerning these matters. He would explain that it was Bahira's father who had brought home the magazine from Germany that showed photos of naked men and women, and it was this filth from the West that had corrupted him. Bahira had found the magazine hidden beneath bags of rice in their house and had stolen it and showed it to Khalil. They had looked at the photographs together, a sin that would have gotten them both whipped if they'd been caught. But instead of the photographs filling them with disgust and shame, it was these pictures that had been the cause of their speaking of the unspeakable. She had said to him, "I want to show myself to you like these women. I want to show you all that I have. I want to see you, Asad, and feel your flesh." And so Satan had entered her, and through her had entered him. He had read the story of Adam and Eve in the Hebrew book of Genesis, and had been told by his Moshiad, his spiritual teacher, that women were weak and lustful and had committed the original sin and would lure men to sin if men did not remain strong. And yet, he thought even great men like the colonel could be corrupted by women. He would explain that to the colonel if he were caught. Perhaps they would not stone Bahira to death and would let them off with a whipping. The night was cool, and Khalil shivered. He remained kneeling on his prayer mat, Quran in his hands. At 2:10, there was a noise on the stairs, and he looked up to see a dark outline standing at the opening of the tin shed. He said softly, "Allah be merciful." Chapter 15. Lieutenant Chip Wiggins said to Lieutenant Bill Southerwaite, "We're getting a strong crosswind. There's that south wind that blows out of the desert. What's it called?"
"It's called the south wind that blows out of the desert?"
"Right. Anyway, that'll be a good tailwind getting the hell out of there. Plus, we'll be 4 bombs lighter." Southerwaite mumbled a reply. Wiggins stared out the windscreen into the dark night. He had no idea if he'd see the sun rise on this day, but he knew that if they accomplished their mission, they'd be heroes. But nameless heroes. For this was no ordinary war. This was a war against international terrorists whose reach went beyond the Middle East, and thus the names of the pilots on this mission would never be released to the press or the public, and would be classified top secret for all time. Something about that rubbed Wiggins the wrong way. It was an admission that the bad guys could reach out right into the heartland of America and exact a revenge against the pilots and crew or their families. On the other hand, even though there would be no parades or public award ceremonies, this anonymity made him a little more comfortable. Better to be an unnamed hero than a named terrorist target. They continued east over the Mediterranean. Wiggins thought about how many wars had been fought around this ancient sea, and especially on the shores of North Africa. The Phoenicians, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Carthaginians, the Romans, the Arabs, on and on for thousands of years, right up until the Second World War. The Italians, the German Africa Corps, the British, the Americans. The sea and the sand of North Africa was a mass grave of soldiers, sailors, and airmen. "To the shores of Tripoli," he said to himself, aware that he was not the only flyer that night to think those words. "We will fight our country's battles." Southerwaite asked, "Time till turn?" Wiggins came out of his reverie and checked his position. 12 minutes.
"Keep the clock."
"Roger." 12 minutes later, the formation began a 90-degree turn to the south. The entire air armada, minus tankers, was on a course toward the Libyan coast. Southerwaite pushed his throttles forward, and the F-111 gathered speed. Bill Southerwaite scanned the clock and the flight instruments. They were approaching the aerial gate where the attack preparations and profiles would begin. He noted his indicated airspeed at true 480 knots and his altitude at 25,000 feet. They were less than 200 miles from the coast and headed dead on for Tripoli. He heard a series of radio clicks, which he acknowledged in kind, and with the rest of his squadron, began his descent. Southerwaite was inclined to start the final checklists right then, but he knew that it was a little early, that it was possible to get yourself peaked too soon, and that was not a smart way to go into combat. He waited. Wiggins cleared his throat, and over the interphone it sounded like a roar and gave them both a start. Wiggins said, 100 miles to feet dry, using the aviator's term for land.
Roger.
They both looked at the radar screen, but there was nothing coming out of Libya to greet and meet them. They leveled off at a mere 300 feet above sea level.
80 miles.
Okay, let's get started on the attack review.
Ready.
Southerwaite and Wiggins began the litanies of the checklist and reviews. Just as they were finished, Wiggins looked up and saw the lights of Tripoli straight ahead.
Tally-ho!
Southerwaite looked up too and nodded. He moved the hydraulic wing position lever, and the outstretched wings of the F-111 began to sweep further aft, like the wings of a hawk who spotted his meal on the ground. Wiggins noticed that his heart had speeded up a little, and he realized he was very thirsty.
Satherwaite increased power again as the F-111s approached the coast in formation. Their run-in altitude remained at 300 feet, and they'd been told there were no radio towers or skyscrapers that high to worry about. Their run-in speed was now 500 knots. It was 0-150 hours. In a few minutes, they'd break formation and head toward their individual targets in and around Tripoli. Wiggins listened closely to the silence in his headset, then heard a warbling tone that indicated a radar lock-on. Oh, shit. He looked quickly at his radar homing and warning screen and said, with as cool a tone as he was able to fake, SAM alert at 1 o'clock. Satherwaite nodded. I guess they're awake. I'd like to kick that briefing officer in the nuts. He's not the problem, and neither are those missiles. Right. The F-111 was flying too low and fast for the missiles to score a hit, but now, at 300 feet, they were squarely in the killing zone of the anti-aircraft guns. Wiggins watched two missiles rise up on his radar screen, and he hoped these Soviet-made pieces of junk really couldn't track them at their speed and altitude. A few seconds later, Wiggins visually spotted the two missiles off their starboard side, streaking upward into the night sky, with their fiery tails burning red and orange. Satherwaite commented dryly, "A waste of expensive rocket fuel." It was Wiggins' turn not to reply. He was, in fact, finally speechless. In total contrast, Satherwaite was now chatty and was going on about the shape of the coastline and the city of Tripoli and other inconsequential matters. Wiggins wanted to tell him to shut up and fly. They crossed over the coast, and below them lay Tripoli. Satherwaite noted that despite the air raid in progress, the streetlights were still on. Idiots. He caught a glimpse of the arch of Marcus Aurelius and said to Wiggins, "There's your arch, 9 o'clock." But Wiggins had lost interest in history and concentrated on the moment. Turn. Satherwaite peeled out of the formation and began his run-in toward Al-Azizah. How do you say that word? What? Where we're going? Wiggins felt sweat forming around his neck as he divided his attention between the instruments, the radar, and the visuals outside his windscreen. Holy shit! Triple A! Are you sure? I thought it was Al something. Wiggins didn't like or appreciate Satherwaite's sudden cockpit humor. He snapped back, Al-Azizah. What fucking difference does it make? Right, Satherwaite replied. Tomorrow, they'll call it rubble. He laughed. Wiggins laughed, too, despite the fact that he was scared out of his mind. Arcs of anti-aircraft tracers cut through the black night much too close to their aircraft. He couldn't believe he was actually being shot at. This really sucked. But it was also a rush. Satherwaite said, Al-Azizah, dead on. Ready. Rubble, replied Wiggins. Rubble, rubble, toil, and trouble. Ready to release. Fuck you, Momar. Chapter 16.
Assad.
Assad Khalil's heart almost stopped.
Yes. Yes, over here. He asked quietly. Are you alone? Of course.
Bahira walked toward his voice, then saw him kneeling on the prayer rug.
Stay low, he whispered hoarsely.
She crouched below the parapet as she moved toward him, then knelt on the prayer rug in front of him.
Is everything all right?
Yes, but you were late.
I had to avoid the guards, the great leader.
Yes, I know. Assad Khalil looked at Bahira in the moonlight. She was wearing the flowing white robe that was a young woman's customary garment in the evenings, and she also wore her veil and scarf. She was 3 years older than he and had reached an age when most women in Libya were married or betrothed. But her father had turned down many suitors, and the most ardent of them had been exiled from Tripoli. Assad Khalil knew that if his own father were alive, the families would certainly have agreed to a marriage between Assad and Bahira. But though his father was a hero and a martyr, the fact was that he was dead, and the Khalil family had little status except as favored pensioners of the great leader.
Of course, there was a connection between the great leader and Assad's mother, but that was a hidden sin and of no help. They knelt facing each other and neither spoke. Bahira's eyes went to the Quran lying at the corner of the rug. Then she seemed to notice the rug itself. She stared at Assad, whose look seemed to say, "If we are to commit the sin of fornication, what difference does it make if we also commit a blasphemy?" Bahira nodded in agreement to the silent understanding. Bahira Nadir took the initiative and pulled aside the veil that covered her face. She smiled, but Khalil thought it was more a smile of embarrassment at being without her veil, less than a meter away from a man. She slid the scarf off her head and unfastened her hair, which fell in long, curly strands over her shoulders. Assad Khalil took a deep breath and stared into Bahira's eyes. She was beautiful, he thought, though he had little with which to compare. He cleared his throat and said to her, "You are very beautiful." She smiled, reached out, and took his hands in hers. Khalil had never held the hands of a woman and was surprised at how small and soft Bahira's hands were. Her skin was warm, warmer than his, probably the result of her exertions in traveling the 300 meters between her home and this place. He also noticed that her hands were dry while his were moist. He moved closer to her on his knees and smelled now a flowered scent coming from her. He discovered as he moved that he was fully aroused. Neither of them seemed to know what to do next. Finally, Bahira let go of his hands and began caressing his face. He did the same to her face. She moved closer to him and their bodies touched. Then they embraced, and he could feel her breasts beneath her robe. Assad Khalil was wild with desire, but a part of his brain was elsewhere. A primitive instinct was telling him to be alert. Before he knew what was happening, Bahira had moved back and was unfastening her robe. Khalil watched her and listened for signs of danger. If they were discovered now, they were dead. He heard her saying, "Assad, what are you waiting for?" He looked at her kneeling before him. She was completely naked now, and he stared at her breasts, then her pubic hair, then her thighs, and finally back at her face. "Assad?" He pulled his short tunic over his head, then slipped his pants and undershorts down to his ankles and kicked them off. She stared at his face, her eyes avoiding his erect penis, but then her eyes glanced downward at him. Assad didn't know what to do next. He thought he would know. He understood the position they would assume, but he was not sure how to arrive at it. Bahira again took the initiative and lay down on her back on the prayer mat, her garments beneath her head. Assad nearly lunged forward and found himself on top of her and felt her firm breasts and warm skin beneath his own. He felt her legs parting and sensed the tip of his penis touching warm, wet flesh. In an instant, he was half inside her. She cried out, softly, in pain. He thrust further, past the resistance, and entered her fully. Before he could move, he felt her hips rise and fall, and between two heartbeats, he released himself inside of her. He lay motionless, catching his breath, but she continued the rising and falling of her hips, though Assad didn't know why she continued after he was satisfied. She started to moan and breathe heavily, then began saying his name, "Assad, Assad, Assad." He rolled off her and lay on his back, looking at the night sky. The half moon was setting in the west. The stars seemed dull over the lighted compound, a poor, pale imitation of the brilliant stars over the open desert. "Assad." He did not answer. His mind could not yet comprehend what he had just done. She moved closer to him so that their shoulders and legs were touching, but the desire was gone in him. She said, "Are you angry?" "No."
He sat up. We should get dressed. She sat up also and put her head on his shoulder. He wanted to move away from her, but he didn't. Unhappy thoughts began to creep into his mind. What if she became pregnant? What if she wanted to do this again? The next time they would be caught for sure, or she would become pregnant. In either case, one or both of them might die. The law was not clear on some things, and it was usually the families that decided how the disgrace was to be dealt with. Knowing her father, he could imagine no mercy for either of them. For some reason that he couldn't comprehend, he blurted out, "My mother has been with the great leader." Bahira did not reply. Khalil was angry at himself for revealing this secret. He didn't know why he had and didn't know what he felt for this woman. He was dimly aware that the desire for her would return again, and for that reason he knew he should be polite. Still, he wished he were anywhere else but here. He eyed his clothing at the far end of the prayer mat. He noticed, too, a dark stain on the prayer mat where she had lain. Bahira put her arm around him and, with her other hand, stroked his thigh. She said, "Do you think we would be allowed to marry?" "Perhaps." But he didn't think so. He glanced at her hand on his thigh, then noticed the blood on his penis. He realized he should have brought water for washing. She said, "Will you speak to my father?" "Yes," he replied, but he didn't know if he would. A marriage to Bahira Nadir, daughter of Captain Habib Nadir, would be a good thing, but it might be dangerous to ask. He wondered if the old women would examine her and find that she had lost her virginity. He wondered if she were pregnant. He wondered a lot of things, not least of all if he would go unpunished for this sin. He said, "We should go." But she made no move to leave his side. So they remained sitting together. Khalil was getting restless. She began to speak, but he said, "Be still." He had the disquieting feeling that something was happening that he needed to be aware of. His mother had once told him that, like his namesake, the lion, he had been blessed with a sixth sense, or second sight, as it was also called by the old women. He had assumed that everyone could sense danger or know that an enemy was nearby without seeing or hearing anything. But he had come to understand that this feeling was a special gift, and he realized now that what he had sensed all night had nothing to do with Bahira or the military police or being caught in fornication. It had to do with something else, but he didn't know what it was yet. All he knew for certain was that something was wrong out there. Chip Wiggins tried to ignore the streaks of tracer rounds sailing past his canopy. He had no point of reference in his life or in his training for what was happening. The whole scene around him was so surreal that he couldn't process it as mortal danger. He concentrated on the display screens that made up the flight console in front of him. He cleared his throat and said to Satherwaite, "We're on the money." Satherwaite acknowledged with no inflection in his voice. Wiggins said, "Less than 2 minutes to target." "Roger." Satherwaite knew he was supposed to kick in the afterburners now for a power boost, but to do so would cause a very long and very visible trail of bright exhaust behind his aircraft, which would draw every gun muzzle in his direction. There wasn't supposed to be this much ground fire, but there was, and he had to make a decision. Wiggins said, "Afterburners, Bill." Satherwaite hesitated. The attack plan called for the extra speed of the afterburners, where he stood a good chance that his squadron mate, Remit 22, who was only 30 seconds behind him, would be climbing up his ass. "Bill." "Right." Satherwaite kicked in the afterburners, and the F-111F shot forward. He pulled back on his stick, and the nose rose. Satherwaite glanced above his flight panel for a brief second and saw an elaborate display of lethal trajectories pass off to their port side. "Those assholes can't shoot straight." Wiggins wasn't so sure about that. He said, "On track, 30 seconds to release." Bahira held her lover's arm.
What is wrong, Assad?
Be quiet. He listened intently and thought he heard someone shout in the far distance. A vehicle started its engine close by. He scrambled toward his clothes and pulled his tunic on, then stood, peeking over the parapet. His eyes scanned the compound below, then something on the horizon caught his attention, and he looked north and east toward Tripoli. Bahira was beside him now, clutching her clothes to her breasts.
What is it? She asked insistently.
I don't know. Be still. Something was terribly wrong, but whatever it was could not be seen or heard yet, though he felt it now, very strongly. He stared into the night and listened.
Bahira, too, peeked over the parapet. Guards?
No. Something out there. Then he saw it. Incandescent trails of bright fire curving up from the glow of the city of Tripoli into the dark sky above the Mediterranean. Bahira saw them too and asked, What is that?
Missiles.
In the name of Allah the Merciful.
Missiles and anti-aircraft fire.
Bahira grabbed his arm.
Assad, what is happening?
Enemy attack.
No, no. Oh, please.
She dropped to the floor and began pulling on her clothes.
We must get to the shelters.
Yes. He pulled on his pants and shoes, forgetting his undershorts. Suddenly, the ear-splitting shriek of an air raid siren filled the night air. Men began to shout and run out of the surrounding buildings. Engines started, the streets filled with noise. Bahira began running barefoot toward the stair shed, but Khalil caught up with her and pulled her down.
Wait! You can't be seen running from this building. Let the others get to the shelters first.
She looked at him. She trusted his judgment, and she nodded. Satisfied that she would stay where she was, Khalil ran back to the parapet and looked toward the city.
In the name of Allah.
Flames were erupting in Tripoli, and he could now hear and feel the distant explosions like rolling desert thunder. Then something else caught his eye, and he saw a shadowy blur hurtling toward him, backlighted by the lights and fires of Tripoli. From the blur trailed an enormous plume of red and white, and Khalil knew he was looking at the hot exhaust gases of a jet aircraft coming right at him. He stood frozen in terror, and not even a scream could rise from his throat. Bill Satherwaite again took his eyes off the electronic displays and grabbed another quick glimpse through his windscreen. Out of the darkness in front of them, he could recognize the aerial view of Al-Azizia that he'd seen 100 times in satellite photos. Wiggins said, Stand by. Satherwaite shifted his attention back to the screens and concentrated on his flying and on the bomb toss pattern that he would execute in a few seconds. Wiggins said, 3, 2, 1. Drop! Satherwaite felt the aircraft lighten immediately and fought for control as he began the high-speed evasive maneuvers that would get them the hell out of there. Wiggins was now working the controls that guided the 2,000-pound laser-smart bombs on their paths to their pre-assigned targets. Wiggins said, Tracking. Good picture. Got it. Steering. Impact! 1, 2, 3, 4. Beautiful. They could not hear the 4 bombs detonating inside the Al-Azizia compound, but both of them could imagine the sound and the flash of the explosions. Satherwaite said, We're out of here. Wiggins added, Bye-bye, Mr. Arabian guy. Assad could do nothing but stare at the incredible thing streaking toward him with fire belching out of its tail. Suddenly, the attacking jet pulled straight up into the night sky, and its roar drowned out everything except Bahira Nadir's scream. The jet disappeared, and the sound subsided, but Bahira continued to scream and scream. Khalil shouted to her, Be quiet! He glanced down into the street and saw 2 soldiers looking up toward him. He ducked below the parapet. Bahira was sobbing now. As Khalil contemplated his next move, the roof beneath his feet jumped and threw him face down. The next thing he was aware of was the sound of an enormous explosion close by. Then there was another explosion, then another. He covered his ears with his hands. The earth shook. He could feel the air pressure change, and his ears popped, and his mouth opened in a silent scream. A rush of heat swept over him. The sky turned blood red, and pieces of rock, rubble, and earth began to fall from the heavens.
Allah, be merciful. Spare me.
The world was being destroyed around him. He had no air in his lungs, and he fought to get his breath. Everything was strangely quiet, and he realized he was deaf. He also realized that he had wet himself. Little by little, his hearing returned, and he could hear Bahira screaming again, an outpouring of pure, unmitigated terror. She scrambled to her feet and staggered over to the far parapet and began screaming down into the courtyard below.
Shut up!
He ran to her and grabbed for her arm, but she got away from him and began running around the rubble-strewn perimeter of the roof, shrieking at the top of her lungs. Four more explosions erupted at the far east end of the compound. Khalil spotted men on the adjoining roof setting up an anti-aircraft machine gun. Bahira saw them too and threw up her arms to them, shouting, "Help! Help!" They saw her, but continued setting up the machine gun.
"Help me! Help!"
Khalil grabbed her from behind and pulled her down to the concrete roof.
"Shut up!"
She fought with him, and he was amazed at her strength. She continued to scream, broke free of his arms, and clawed at his face, opening gashes along his cheeks and neck. Suddenly, the machine gun on the next building opened fire, and the staccato sound mixed with the wailing siren and the thuds of explosion in the distance. Red tracer rounds streaked up from the machine gun, and this caused Bahira to scream again. Khalil put his hand over her mouth, but she bit his finger, then brought her knee up into his groin, and he rocked backwards. She was completely hysterical, and he could see no way to calm her down. But there was a way. He put his hands around her neck and throat and squeezed. The F-111 streaked southward over the desert, then Satherwaite banked hard to starboard and executed a 150-degree turn that would bring them back over the coast, 100 kilometers west of Tripoli. Wiggins said, "Nice flying, Skipper." Satherwaite didn't acknowledge but said, "Keep an eye out for the Libyan Air Force, Chip." Wiggins adjusted the knobs on his radar screen. "Clear skies. Gaddafi's pilots are washing their underwear about now."
"We hope."
The F-111 had no air-to-air missiles, and the idiots who designed it hadn't even put a Gatling gun on board, so their only defense against another jet was speed and maneuver.
"We hope," he repeated.
Satherwaite sent out a radio signal indicating that Karma 57 was among the living. They sat in silence waiting for the other signals. Finally, the radio signals began coming in. Remit 22, with Terry Wycliffe piloting and Bill Hambrecht as Wizzo. Remit 61, with Bob Callum piloting, Steve Cox, Wizzo. Elton 38, with Paul Gray piloting, Jim McCoy, Wizzo. Their whole flight had made it. Wiggins said, "I hope the other guys did okay." Satherwaite nodded. So far, this was a perfect mission, and that made him feel good. He liked it when everything went as planned. Aside from the missiles and the AAA, which in any case had not done him or his flightmates any harm, this could have been a live bomb training mission over the Mojave Desert. Satherwaite jotted an entry in his log. "Piece of cake." "Milk run," Wiggins agreed. Asad Khalil kept squeezing, and this had the intended effect of making her stop screaming. She looked at him with wide, bulging eyes. He squeezed harder, and she began to thrash around beneath him. He squeezed even harder, and the thrashing turned to muscle spasms. Then even those stopped. He kept the pressure on her throat and looked into Bahira's eyes, which were wide open and unblinking. He counted to 60 and released his hands from her neck. He had solved the problem of the present and all the problems of the future with one relatively simple act. He stood, put his Quran on the prayer mat, rolled it and tied it, put it over his shoulder and went down the stairs and out the building into the street. All the lights in the compound were out, and he made his way through the darkness toward his home. With every step he took away from the building where Bahira lay dead on the roof, he was that much more removed, physically and mentally, from any involvement with the dead girl. A building in front of him was in ruins, and by the light of the burning structure, he He saw dead soldiers lying all around him. A man's face stared up at him, the white skin reddened by the reflected flames. The man's eyes had popped out of his skull, and blood ran from his eye sockets, his nose, his ears, and his mouth. Khalil fought down the nausea in his churning stomach, but he caught a whiff of burning flesh and vomited. He rested a moment, then pushed on, still carrying his prayer mat. He wanted to pray, but the Quran specifically prohibited a man from praying after he had intercourse with a woman unless he first washed himself, including his face and hands. He saw a ruptured cistern pouring water down the side of a building, and he stopped to wash his face and hands, then washed the blood and urine from his genitals. He moved on, reciting long passages from the Quran, praying for the safety of his mother, sisters, and brothers. He saw fires raging from the direction he was headed, and he began running. This night, he reflected, had begun in sin and ended in hell. Lust led to sin, sin led to death. Hellfires raged all around him. The great Satan himself had delivered punishment to him and to Bahira. But Allah the Merciful had spared his life, and as he ran, he prayed that Allah had also spared his family. As an afterthought, he also prayed for Bahira's family and for the great leader. As Asad Khalil, age 16, ran through the ruins of Al-Aziziyah, he understood that he had been tested by Satan and by Allah, and that from this night of sin, death, and fire, he would emerge a man. Chapter 17. Asad Khalil continued running toward his home. There were more people in this quarter of the compound. Soldiers, women, a few children, and they were running or walking slowly as if stunned. Some, he realized, were on their knees praying. Khalil turned a corner and stopped, dead in his tracks. The row of attached stucco houses where he lived looked strangely different. Then he realized there were no shutters on the windows, and he noticed debris strewn in the open square in front of the houses. But even more strange was the fact that moonlight came through the open windows and doors. He suddenly realized that the roofs had collapsed into the buildings and blown out the doors, windows, and shutters. Allah, I beg of you, please, no. He felt as if he were going to faint. Then he took a deep breath and ran toward his house, stumbling over pieces of concrete, dropping his prayer mat, finally reaching the doorway opening. He hesitated, then rushed inside to what had been the front room. The entire flat roof had collapsed into the room, covering the tile floor, the rugs, and the furniture with broken slabs of concrete, wooden beams, and stucco. Khalil looked upward at the open sky. In the name of the Most Merciful. He took another deep breath and tried to get himself under control. On the far wall was the wood and tile cabinet that his father had built. Khalil made his way across the rubble to the cabinet whose doors had been flung open. He found the flashlight inside and switched it on. He swept the powerful narrow beam around the room, seeing now the full extent of the damage. A framed photograph of the great leader still hung on the wall, and this somehow reassured Khalil. He knew that he had to go into the bedrooms, but he couldn't bring himself to face what might be there. Finally, he told himself, "You must be a man. You must see if they are dead or alive." He moved toward an arched opening that led further back into the house. The cooking and eating room had suffered the same damage as the front room. Khalil noticed that his mother's dishes and ceramic bowls had all fallen off their shelves. He passed through the destruction into a small inner courtyard where three doors led to the three bedrooms. Khalil pushed on the door to the room that he shared with his two brothers, Isam, age 5, and Kadir, age 14. Isam was the posthumous son of his father, always sickly and was indulged by his sisters and mother. The great leader himself had sent for a European doctor once to examine him during one of his illnesses. Kadir, only 2 years younger than Asad, was big for his age and sometimes mistaken as his twin. Asad Khalil had hopes and dreams that Kadir and he would join the army together, become great warriors, and eventually become army commanders and aides to the great leader. Asad Khalil held on to this image as he pushed on the door, which encountered some obstruction on the other side and held fast.
He pushed harder and managed to squeeze himself through the narrow opening into his room. There were three single beds in the small room, his own, which was flattened under a slab of concrete, Kadir's bed, which was also buried in concrete rubble, and Isam's bed, across which Khalil could see a huge rafter. Khalil scrambled over to the rubble to Isam's bed and knelt beside it. The heavy timber had landed lengthwise on the bed, and beneath the timber, under the blanket, was Isam's crushed and lifeless body. Khalil put his hands over his face and wept. He got himself under control and turned toward Kadir's bed. The entire bed was buried under a section of concrete and stucco roof. Khalil's flashlight played over the mound of debris, and he saw a hand and arm protruding from the concrete pieces. He reached out and grasped the hand, then quickly let go of the dead flesh. He let out a long, plaintive wail and threw himself across the mound of debris covering Kadir's bed. He cried for a minute or two, but then realized